Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chav Dalet Amud Aleph, three lines down. Gemara here is continuing to discuss the memra of Rabbi Chanina that we saw yesterday, which is rov vikarov. When you have a competition between two means of evidence, rov means the majority, karov means something that is proximate. Over there, Rabbi Chanina said, holchim achar rov, that the majority governs in those situations. Amar Abaye, afana namitanina. We have a Mishnah from the Gemara Nida that supports this contention of Rabbi Chanina. It's found in the Gemara Nida on Daf Yud Zayin. Over there, the Mishnah begins, Mashal Mashlu Chachamim B'Isha. Chachamim gave this parable with regards to a woman. The Mishnah there, using euphemistic terms, is trying to describe the anatomy of the woman. And there, it describes the woman when she is lying in supine on her back, that there is a area of the woman called the cheder, which is the room or the inner chamber, which refers to the uterus, and which is the source of all the menstrual blood that comes out of the woman. Then it describes the puzdor, which is a hallway or a alley, which the Gemara is using to describe the vaginal canal, which brings the blood from the uterus to the outside of the woman. And then it says that there is aliyah agabe shtehem. There is this attic that sits on top of both of them. Seemingly from the description over there, and you can see if you go to Daf Yud Zayin and Nida, I have diagrams that describe this and show the anatomy, that is referring to the urinary bladder that sits on top when the woman is in supine, laying on her back, that sits on top of both the vaginal canal and the uterus. And then the Gemara there describes that there's lul katan. There is a small passageway which comes from the urinary bladder down into the vaginal canal. The problem with that description and what we're going to see today in the Gemara is that it's just not anatomically correct, which is that there is no connection between the reproductive system and the urinary system of the woman. So you either have to suggest that what the Gemara is describing over here is very close to the surface, which means that at the point where the urine leaves the body or the menstrual blood leaves the body, that's where the Gemara is speaking about this issue of mixing, or you have to speak about some sort of disease or damage that is caused from pregnancy that perforated the separation between the urinary bladder and the vaginal canal, which allows the blood from the urinary tract to mix with the dam nida, or the dam that comes from the uterus. There, that Mishnah's by says, dam shenivtza bepuzdor, blood is found in the vaginal canal, sfeko tameh. Even though it's dam that is safek, it is considered to be tameh. We consider it to be vadai tameh, that's how Rashi describes it over here. Because we assume that it came from the uterus, and blood that comes from the uterus is menstrual blood, and that is dam tameh. Even though the attic is closer by, meaning that the urinary bladder is closer to the location where we found the blood. So here you have a competition between rov. Majority of blood flows from the uterus, yet there's karov. The closest location to where we've discovered the blood is actually the urinary bladder. Again, assuming that there's some connection between the two or some way for the blood to flow from one to the other. Despite that fact, we're assuming it comes from the uterus. So Abaye says that Mishnah corroborates what Rabbi Chanina says. Here you have a competition between evidence of something that is rov and something that is karov, and we let rov govern over there, and therefore the dam that is found in the vaginal canal is considered to be tamei or menstrual blood. So I'm going to say rov. Rov says back to Abaye, rov umatsui kamart. Over there, you're not talking about a simple rove. You're talking about rove umatsui. Rove umatsui, leket mandamar. There is nobody who disagrees with this position of rove umatsui, which means that not only is it a majority, but it is also matsui. The way Rashi describes it over here, you're talking about two different terms. Rove means damav rabim yoter. Rove means that the majority of blood, meaning that quantitatively, there is more blood that comes from the uterus than that which comes from the urinary bladder. And that's what we're speaking about, rov. Matsui is shehein tidirim lazuv misham. That it is regular, or on a regular basis, blood flows from the uterus. That's not true of the urinary bladder or the urinary tract. In general, you don't find blood there. And if you do find blood there, it's drops of blood. It's not a flow of blood. And therefore, the situation here is not simply a rov. It's a rov umatsui. And it's something that is much more commonplace. And therefore, you have two factors that are governing rather than simply a simple majority or rov. That's the way Rashi describes it. You could say that rov umatsui is also a term of consistent, which is that the dam from the mekor, from the uterus, comes out on a more consistent basis versus that blood that is found in the urinary tract, which only happens in rare occasions. So you could say that the matsui, not like Rashi is describing over here, which is that it normally comes from the uterus, but rather that it persistently or consistently comes from the uterus. Or you could also explain rovu matsui not being two separate terms, but a description of the rove itself, which is that rovu matsui means that this is a majority that is a supermajority. Some rove can be anywhere from 51% up to 99%. So here, when we say rovu matsui, this is a rove on the scale of rove that is closer to 100 than it is to 50. But a regular rove could be closer to 50 than it is to 100. And that's what it means, rovu matsui. So any one of those interpretations, Rava says, is relevant over here. And that description of rovu matsui, nobody disagrees with Rabbi Hanina's position there. Rabbi Hanina made his statement even with a regular rove. Over here we're talking about this rovu matsui. There everybody agrees to his position, and therefore there's no evidence from the Mishnah in Nidah. Now, the next statement of the Gemara, it's not clear whether there should be a dalet here. Ditani Rabbi Chia. Because Rabbi Chia had a braita. Question is, the duh, because of what? What is that trying to prove? So the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it simply that that is a proof to Rova's position. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot don't like that explanation and say, Ditani, if you have the girsa of the dalet there, is referencing back to Abaye's explanation of the Mishnah in Nidah. The Tani shows you that his explanation of the Mishnah he does correct, although the Tosafot favors an explanation of Tani Rabbi Chia. This is a completely independent statement and not connected to the previous Gemara. And then the Maharam, in a second, will discuss an alternative explanation. Tani Rabbi Chia, we have a Braita, Dama Nimtza Bipruzdor, the blood that is found in the vaginal canal, Chayevin Alav Al Biat Migdash. If a woman, while she is tmeyah, tumat nida, enters into the mikdash, she is chayevet, she did it bishogeg, to bring a korban for that. Sofim alav et truma. And if she came into contact with truma, we burn it. What you see from the braita of Rabbi Chia is that we treat this tuma like tuma vadait, that we treat it as if it is full-fledged tuma. We don't say that it's a safek tuma. If it was a safek, then when she entered into the mikdash, we'd say she is chayevet a korban. But since it's a safek, we're not going to let you bring the korban because there's a risk that you're bringing chulin into the azara. With truma, also, we would use a terminology of tolim. We wait and see what the status of it is. We don't burn it, but we don't eat it, and we wait for it to deteriorate or become tamei vadai, and then we burn it. But in the interim, we wait. Here, where the bright of Rabbi Chia says that we treat this as if it is truma vadait. That is the basic principle that is laid out by what Rabbi Chia is saying. Now, if you connect it back to what was said before, the Rabbeinu Gershom reads this as a proof to Rova's position, which is, it's clear here that we're speaking about a rove in Matsui in the case of Dam Nidah, because you see from the way that Rabbi Chia treats the Tuma here, that he treats it as Tuma Vadait, not even as a Safek Tuma. That shows you that this is Rova Matsui, and this is a different type of rove than we're normally discussing, because a regular rove would result in a halacha that involves a Safek. That's the way Rabbeinu Gershom reads it. The Balei HaTosafot read it as a proof to Abaye. That Abaye is reading of the Mishnah that says, Sfeko Tamei, it doesn't mean that it's Tamei Misafek, but rather Sfeko, that Safek, is Tamei Vadait. And that reading is a correct reading of the Mishnah because you see the way that Rabbi Chia describes the same thing, and he calls it Tuma Vadait. According to the Balei HaTosafot, this may be a totally independent statement, which precipitates the next part of the Gemara, which is Amar Rova, Shma Minam Mid Rabbi Chia. Rova says, from Rabbi Chia, you could conclude, Slat, three things from this. That's the way the Tosfot read it. This is a totally new piece of information, which then Rava makes his comment about. And these are the three things that you could conclude from it. Shma mina, rov u karov, halech achara rov. When you have a competition between rov and karov, we go after rov, because over here you have the rov of the dam coming from the uterus, and you have karov, it's closer to whatever connection there is to the urinary tract. Nevertheless, we let the rove dictate and say that the dam is dam tamei. Ushmamina ruba do raita. In addition, you conclude from here that rove, or relying on a rove, is a Torah principle, because based on this principle, we're going to allow the woman to bring a kurban in the migdash. We also are going to be soref truma. We're going to burn truma based on it. So here, this has halachic implications that are at the Torah level, and that means that rove must dictate at a Torah level. Now, even though the Pasuk says, and it's an explicit Pasuk in the Torah, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, that we always follow the majority, as the Balei HaTosafot point out over here, that's only true, Beruba Deita Kaman. That's only Torah speaking about a case where we can see the robe in front of us. For instance, the Pasuk speaking about the voting in a Beit Din. When it comes to a court voting, we follow the majority. So over there, you can see the majority in front of you, and the majority dictates. That's where the Pasuk is speaking about. But Ruba Daleta de Kaman, when we're going to rely on a majority that is not in front of us, and we cannot corroborate that majority, we're doing it based on the statistical knowledge that this is the majority. How do we know that's the case? That's what Rava is saying comes out of this statement of Rabbi Chiya that we wouldn't have known from the Pasuk. That's the way the Balei Tosfot read the Chiddush here. Otherwise, Rava is telling us something that is explicit in the Pasuk. Others simply suggest that even the Pasuk of Acharei Ravim Latot governs whether it's a Ruba that's in front of us, Ruba Dita Kaman, or Ruba Deleta Kaman, whether the robe is apparent or only statistically that we know that that's the case. The Pasuk would govern that, and the Chiddush here is that when Rove comes up against other evidentiary claims, Rove still wins. And that's what he's saying, that Ruba Doraita, that Rove has power to overcome other offsetting pieces of evidence. Mishmamina, Ita the Rabbi Zeira. In addition, it also shows us that we hold like Rabbi Zeira, Tami Rabbi Zeira. Afo Pisha Daltot Medina Ne'ulot, even though the gates of the city are closed, there still is a Rove that governs. The statement of Rabbi Zeira is found in the Gemara Ketubot. Over there it's discussing how many roves do you need? How many majorities do you need in order for something to follow the majority? Over there we have positions that believe you need ruba veruba. You need trei rubim. You need two majorities in order for something to be governed by the majority. There we're speaking about yichus. It's true, by yichus the Chachamim made an extra chumrah which says that in the case of yichus, not only do you need the rove members of the city to be people who are miyuchas, you need also to have that another majority there that helps us out. That other majority is when the gates of the city open, and not only do you have the majority of the city, you also have the majority of the alma, the majority of the world, because now the city is accessible. If the doors of the city are closed, then you're dealing only with one majority, which is the majority of the people within the city. And so what Rabbi Zeira says is, even when the doors of the city are closed, rove majority governs. Because a woman is the equivalent of a city whose doors are sealed. Because the blood or the dam that we're speaking about here can only come internally from the woman. It's not coming from any external source. Given that, you are only open to what happens inside the anatomy of the woman. And that's only one rove. Despite the fact that there's only one rove here, kazlinen bataruva, we go after that rove, we follow that majority. And that's what Rava is saying from here. You see that you only need one majority in order to govern. You don't need a double majority in order to govern. And that's shown by what Rabbi Chiya says over here. You only have one rove here, which is that majority of the dam comes from the mekor, from the uterus, and not from the urinary tract. And therefore, that one rove governs. So now, going back to what the Balei Tosafot asked before, what is the point of the Tani Rabbi Chiya? So over here you have an additional suggestion by the Maharam that says that what Rava is showing from this Braita of Rabbi Chiya is that based on the fact that Rabbi Chiya tells us in the Braita that Rovu Karov, Rov governs, then Rabbi Hanina's statement must be adding something. What is it that he is adding? And that's what Rava shows you, which is that Rabbi Chiya's statement is only by a case of Rov Matsui. Based on that, Rabbi Hanina's statement is even in a case where there is no Rov Matsui. And that's what he's bringing from Rabbi Chiya to show you that Rabbi Hanina is adding an additional Chidush. And that's why it's Detani. Because Rabbi Chiya shows us, or is Mar'an on Rabbi Hanina's statement as to what the nature of that statement is. Because from Rabbi Chiya already you would know Rov Vikarov, Rov governs. What Rava says is that's because over there it's a Rov Matsui. But in the case of Rabbi Hanina, his statement, what he's adding on top of Rabbi Chiya, is that Rov Vikarov, Rov governs, even in a case when it's not Matsui, and that's the proof to his point. Now, as the Gemara notes over here, there's a problem, because now we have a stira in Rava's position. Rava said before that by Rov Matsui, everybody agrees, and seemingly he brought that proof, or he connected that to the statement of Rabbi Chiya. But now Rava is saying three things we can conclude from Rabbi Chiya's statement. One of them is that Rov Vikarov, that Rov governs. So how does Rava come to that conclusion if he thinks that Rabbi Chiya is speaking about a case of Rov Matsui? So therefore, how does he come to the conclusion that Rov Vikarov, Rov governs? Rav Matsui Lek Leman Da Amar. Didn't Rav already say that when it comes to Rav Matsui, nobody disagrees? So what is exactly he concluding from this statement of Rabbi Chiya that Rov Vikarov, this is a Rov Vikarov that everybody agrees to? Hadabe Rova Mihahi. Rova backed away from that position that the case of Rabbi Chiya is a case of Rov Umatsui. And therefore Abaye's proof then is a good proof, because if it's not a case of Rov Umatsui, then you could prove from this the statement of Rabbi Chiya and the Mishnah that Abaye brought, which is clarified by this statement of Rabbi Chiya, when it comes to Rov Ukarov, that Rov governs, because this is not a case of Rov Umatsui. And that's what the Maram then explains. Now, that's what Rabbi Chanina is coming to teach us. The Chiddush of Rabbi Chanina is, don't read the statement of Rabbi Chiya being only true in the case of Rov Umatsui. Rabbi Chanina's statement is coming to tell you that Rabbi Chiya's statement is even about a case of Rov Ukarov. And that's his Chiddush. The truth is, you could have learned it out of Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chanina comes to teach us how to read Rabbi Chiya. Don't read Rabbi Chiya like the Havamina of Rova, that was a case of Rova Matsui, but rather read it by the conclusion that Rova had, which is that this is a case of a simple Rove, and there Rove will govern over Karov. So now Gemara says Itmar. We have a case, Chavich Tzafa Benar. We have a barrel that is floating along in the river. Amarav, Nimtzeit Keneged Ir Shruba Yisrael. If the barrel is found in the river, opposite or near a city that has a majority of Jewish inhabitants, mutar. The wine is considered to be mutar. We don't worry about it being yayin nesech or stam yenam, that would be asur, because we think that the barrel must have come from the adjacent city, which has a majority of Jewish inhabitants. Kenegedi or shiruba nachrim. On the other hand, if it's found near or opposite a city that its majority of its inhabitants are non-Jews, asira, then it would be asur. Ushmol amar. Shmuel says, "Afilu nimtzeit keneged ir shruba Yisrael." Even if it's found near a city whose the majority of whose inhabitants are Jewish, asira, it is asur. Because Shmuel says, "Imor, let us say, ihi dekira atai," because it came from the city's upriver or the upriver tributaries, so that the source of the barrel doesn't necessarily have to be from the city that is adjacent to; it could be from upriver. Upriver, there's places, the Kirai, which the Gemara mentions in other places, which are non-Jewish areas, where there is no majority of Jews, or there's no Jews that are miuchasim over there. So the assumption would be that if the barrel came from upriver, that it was definitely problematic. And Shmuel says, just because it's found opposite the city, doesn't mean that that's the source of the barrel. The barrel could have come from places or sources of the Prat that are in completely non-Jewish areas. And Tosfos points out that it's lav dafka, that it's found connected to Ir Sheruba Yisrael, that is, Shmuel says it's Asur, but even if it's Ir Shekula Yisrael, even if it was a city that was entirely Yisraelim, he still doesn't think that that is what governs over here. And therefore we have to worry about the fact that it came from somewhere else. So the Gemara says, Lema b'Rabbi Chanina kamitlige. It seems like Rav and Shmuel are arguing exactly in this issue of Rabbi Chanina. Over here you have competing pieces of evidence. You have Karov. The barrel was found proximate to a city. But you also have Rov, which is the majority of people abutting the river, especially if you go upriver, are non-Jewish. So do we look at the Rov, or do we look at the Karov? And what it seems like is that Shmuel holds like Rabbi Chanina, that when you have Rov and Karov, Rov governs. And therefore, we say over here that it's definitely wine that is asur. On the other hand, Rav says we look at the Karov. Where is the barrel proximate to? If it's close to a Jewish city, or if it's close to a non-Jewish city, that will govern, not the Rov. The Gemara says it seems like Rav and Shmuel are arguing exactly in this position of Rabbi Chanina. Demar itlei de Rabbi Chanina. Shmuel will hold like Rabbi Chanina that Rov governs. Umar leilei de Rabbi Chanina. And Rav does not hold the Rabbi Chanina and says that Karov governs. Rav says lo. De kuli alma itlehu de Rabbi Chanina. Everybody holds of Rabbi Chanina. And again, this would then give corroboration to the fact that we would paskin like Rabbi Chanina, because you see the Gemara is focusing on the situation of establishing Rav and Shmuel's machlokin in a case where we do accept Rabbi Chanina, as well as the fact that Abaye and Rava both accepted that position of Rabbi Chanina. That would mean that we would paskin, therefore, like Rabbi Chanina. This is the machlokin between Rav and Shmuel. Demar Savar im Ita, which is that if it were the case, that it came from upriver, it came from those cities that are non-Jewish, that the certain incidents along the river would have caused the barrel to sink, and not to make it downriver. So the word akule, Rashi explains over here, those are areas around the rocks that form these whirlpools, that if something gets caught in the whirlpool, it sinks the item. And pshure are areas where the snow is melting, but it contributes to water that is standing and does not flow. And therefore, the barrel would have stuck there and then sunk because it would just been sitting in the water. So Rav's point is, if you are right, Shmuel, that it came from upriver, it wouldn't have made it this far down because there are too many obstacles on the way that would have sunk the barrel. So the likelihood of it coming from upriver is very low. And therefore, you can't claim that that is a majority because of the whirlpools and the stationary stagnant water would have caused the barrel to sink and not make it this far down. Umar Savar, on the other hand, Shmuel believes, Harifa Denara Nokot Vatai. Shmuel, as he explicitly said before, the reasoning in his position is because it came from upriver. And what he thinks is that the barrel caught the flow of the river, whether that's because the barrel was dropped while they were working or transporting it in the middle of the river, or when it fell into the river, it moved to the middle of the river and it caught the current. And as long as it's on the current, it's not going to get caught in these whirlpools or the stagnant water, and it will make it all the way downriver without sinking. So there's a possibility that this barrel did come from upriver and it would make it this far down. So the machloket is simply about whether a barrel dropped all the way upriver would make it down this far. How plausible is that situation? If you think it's very plausible, then you have a problem now because Ruba the Alma is non-Jewish, or the rove of people who abut the river or the sources of the river are not Jewish, and therefore you have a problem. Rav says that the possibility of the barrel making down this far is low, and therefore, yes, even though I agree with you that there is a rove of non-Jews that could be the source of this barrel, the likelihood of the barrel making this far down is so low that that majority is not relevant over here, and therefore the only thing that matters is the adjacent city to where we find the barrel. They found a barrel of wine that was sitting inside of a vineyard, but it was clear that the vineyard was that of Orla, was something that the grapes there were Orla and Asur b'achilau b'hana'a. Shaya Ravina. Ravina says that the barrel that's found there is mutar to drink, and we don't assume that the wine inside of this barrel comes from the vineyard that is Orla. Lema, mishum de savala, de Rabbi Chanina, okay, Rabbi Chanina. Let us suggest that the reason behind his position is because he holds of Rabbi Chanina. And therefore you have a case of rove and karov. The karov is that it's found now in a vineyard that is of Orla. So then you would suppose that it's asur because of the location in which it's found. The rove is that the majority of people in the city or in this area are Jewish. And therefore the barrel that's found there most likely came from a Jewish vintner. And the wine should be mutar. So he's saying rove governs over karov. And Tosfot says, don't say over here the reason that it is mutar is because it's safek orla b'chutz laretz, and safek orla b'chutz laretz is mutar. Because if we really believe that karov was koveya, we would deem it to be vadai. It would be as if it's 100% considered to be part of this vineyard, and it would be subject to orla mitzad vadaut and not mitzad safek. Mar says, no, shiny hotam. Says it doesn't make so much sense to suggest that the wine is sourced from that particular vineyard. Because if the wine was made in that vineyard and then was stolen by thieves, the thieves would not leave the barrel that they stole in the vineyard from which it was sourced. Because, as Rashi says over here, they're afraid that the harvesters or the pressers will come through and see the barrel there and take it back. When they're going to hide it, they're going to take it out of this location. So the fact that it's found here is in of itself an indication that it probably did not come from here. And therefore, the evidence of karov over here is not really relevant. Tosfot does ask, wait a minute, even if you follow rov in this situation, why does rov help you? The rov of the world or the majority of the world are non-Jews, and therefore the assumption should be that the wine came from somewhere that is problematic. He says, Yesh Lamar, rov ganvei Yisrael. He invokes a principle that the Gemara uses in Avodah Zarah and other places, which is, majority of thieves are Jewish, meaning in the Jewish area where we find this barrel, the likelihood was that it was stolen by Jews. And since it was stolen by Jews, we assume that the wine came from a Jewish vintner, and therefore we don't look at the majority of the world because it's not relevant in this situation. The majority that governs is the thieves and who the thieves steal from. And so the majority of thieves here are Jews, and therefore they're going to steal from their local residents. Therefore, we assume that the barrel here came from a Jewish source, And that's why Rabbi Chanina was matir. Hanu zikei dechamra, the ashkechan beikupai. There were these flasks of wine that were found. Beikupai, Rashi says that they were found in the vineyard. They were buried or hidden in the vineyard. The Tosafot brings from the Oruch that it is the name of a location. Beikupai was the name of a location. That they found these flasks in that location. Sharinu Rava. Rava says they were mutar to drink. We don't assume that this is a yain of a Nachri, but rather we assume that it's a yain of a Jew. Lema, lo savar la de Rabbi Chanina. Let us assume that he's not holding like Rabbi Chanina, because what we're assuming now is that had you gone after Rove, the Rove of the world, or the Rove of the source of wine would be a non-Jewish source. On the other hand, what he is saying is that we're governed by Karov, which is that the location, which is either, according to Rashi, a vineyard that belongs to a Jew, or according to the Balei Tosafot, bring the Oruch, that this is a city that has a majority of Jewish inhabitants, and therefore Karov governs over here. Where we find it is what's governing, and given that, we assume that it is Jewish wine. So then, it seems that Rava is not accepting Rabbi Chanina's position, and that is problematic because Rava himself before says that Rabbi Chanina is correct, and when it comes to Rov and Karov, Rov governs. So why over here is he soter himself contradicting that which he said above, and saying over here that the Karov governs? Mar says, Shani Hotam, Deruva, Deshvochai, Israel Ninhu. Says the majority of wine vintners in that area and people who pour into flasks were Jewish. So in all likelihood, the wine that is found in these flasks, since the majority of the people in that area are Jewish, therefore we assume that the Rov is what's governing, not the Karov. It's not because of where it's located, it's because of the people in the area are generally Jewish. Bahani mile birabreve. That's only true when you speak about large flasks. Avazutre, if they are small flasks, imor me ovre drachim nafol. Then we would suggest that they fell from people who were traveling. Small flasks are taken by people who travel long distances. And so therefore, if they were small flasks that were put there or dropped there, then we can't use the rove of the local vicinity to determine, because now those people could have come from anywhere. And Ruba the Alma are non-Jews. And so therefore, in that case, we would have to say they are asur. So our assumption is that these are larger flasks, which are not used for transporting, or people don't travel with them, rather, for storage. And since the local individuals who create these flasks or pour these flasks are all Jewish, that's why the robe that governs over here means that it's wine that is fine. Ve'ika rabreve behadaihu. If there were small flasks there, and then large flasks with it, imor bavrue habe manche. Then we say that they were used to balance the weight on the animal. The way that Rashi reads it, and the Rabbeinu Gershom also brings himself an interpretation like this, which is that when you find both large and small flasks there, we assume that the wine is mutar, and that the real transport that was being done, or the person who put them there, had large flasks. The smaller flasks there were just used to balance out the larger flasks so that the weight was evenly distributed on the donkey. And therefore, in that case, both the large and small flasks were mutar, and we don't assume that they came from Ovrei Drachim, people who were traveling in that area. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom brings from his Rebbe a different interpretation, which says, V'ika Rabreve, if there are large flasks there, v'ashkach zutre v'adayu, and there are small ones with it, asire, they are sur, that they are sur because we assume that this is a person traveling, and he has a large number of small flasks. In order to balance those large number of small flasks, he put a large flask on the other side. Therefore, the finding of a large flask over here is not evidence of the fact that this is not someone who's transporting or going long distance. Now, the next Mishnah says, Marchikim et ha'ilan min ha'ir esrim v'chamesh amah. One has to distance a tree from the boundaries of the city, a minimum of 25 amot. Rashi over here says, "Bigmar meferish mishum noye ha'ir." It's because of the beauty or aesthetics of the city, because you need some open space around the city. Ubecharuvu shikma. When you're dealing with a carob or a sycamore, chamishay mama, it has to be a minimum of 50 amot away from the edge of the city. Rashi says, "Mishum anafehem rabim." Because they have large number of branches, so therefore they spread or they block a large area. So in order to give you that open space or feeling of open space, you need to distance these trees further away. What's interesting is Rashi on Chaf Hei Amud Bet, when he is describing the nature of Charuv and Shikma, over there it says, Mishum Shoreshehem Merubim, because they have very large roots, which both might be true, But over there, the focus is on the issue of the roots. And over here, the focus is on the aesthetics or the above ground view. The Rabbeinu Gershom just adds that Meishim de'ika tarte de riuta. The Charuv and the Shikma have two things going against it. Chada dein perutem shavim klum. They produce fruit that is worthless. And then, they have large branches or they are very large trees vis-a-vis other trees. So because of those two negative strikes against them, we want them moved away or distanced from the edge of the city. And Abba Sholom er kol ilan srak chamishim ama. Any non-fruit-bearing tree should be a minimum of 50 amot away. Because Rashi says, gnai hu le'ir. It's something that is not beautiful or not aesthetically pleasing to have those non-fruit-bearing trees close to the city. If the city was first, and then the tree was planted after the city already existed, you cut the tree down, and you don't have to compensate for the fact that you cut it down. If the tree was there first, meaning that the tree was there, and then only the city was built after the fact, then you cut it down, and then you compensate for the fact that you cut down the tree, or in essence, you're buying the tree from the individual and cutting it down. Safek zekadam. If we aren't certain as to which was first, the city or the tree, kotseitz, you cut it down, and you don't compensate in that case. My taima. What is the reasoning behind this idea that you have to move these trees away from the edge of the city? Amar ula mishum noye ayir. This is what Rashi quoted for us in the Mishnah. It's because of the beauty of the city, the aesthetics of the city. So now the Gemara asks a question. It's not clear here from the question whether the question is really on ula, or the question is fundamentally on the Mishnah, because Ula is just coming to explain the reasoning in the Mishnah, and therefore it's likely that the question is directed at the Mishnah as a whole. The Ramban, in the end, tries to connect the two and say that the din that is being proposed here in the Mishnah is solely connected to cities in Eretz Yisrael, because there we worry about the aesthetics, and given that Ula explained that this is an aesthetic issue, Mishuv Mishuv Eretz Yisrael, then this question becomes relevant because the next halacha is only relevant in Eretz Yisrael. So there are two assumptions in that. First of all, that our Mishnah is only applicable in Eretz Yisrael, as well as the upcoming din, that it's also only applicable in Eretz Yisrael. There are Rishonim, although in the minority, that argue on both of those points. There are some that say that our Mishnah is applicable to any city, not just cities in Eretz Yisrael, as well as the fact that the din min haTorah, which we're about to discuss as well, which speaks about the Arei Levi'im, the Ramban says it's limited to Eretz Yisrael. There are those, again, a minority view that think that it's applicable to any city. But given the fact that these would be the laws that are limited to Eretz Yisrael, once Ula gives the reason being aesthetics and not nezek or damage, then he's saying that the Mishnah is only relevant in Eretz Yisrael. Once you do that, then the question becomes relevant. But typically, Deino sim sadeh migrash, velo migrash sadeh. The Gemara here is referencing to the Mishnayot in Arachin, which describe or interpret that which is written in the Torah with regards to the Arei Levi'im, that around the Arei Levi'im you have to even leave 2,000 amot around them, or 1,000 amot. The Gemara deals with that stira, that contradiction, by saying that the first 1,000 amot around the city need to be empty space, avir, and give you a sense of openness and fresh air. And after that, the next 1,000 amot are the fields of the city. So therefore, that's a structure of a city. And the Gemara says, based on the Mishnah in Arachin, which says that you're not allowed to change the empty space around the city into fields, and you're not allowed to change the fields into empty space. Given that, then what's the issue with planting trees around the city? Why are you bringing a Mishnah that says the problem is because of Noye Ayir, for the aesthetics of the city? It's a Isur D'Oraita, which is that you have to leave the space, the first 1,000 amot around the city, empty. Planting a tree there would be a violation of turning that area, that migrash, into a sadeh. Where it says, L'tzricha Rabbi Lazar. You need it for the opinion of Rabbi Lazar. D'amar osim sadeh migrash, migrash sadeh. Where he says that the definition or what the Torah says over there, he interprets or deals with the contradiction differently, and says that you are allowed to make the migrash, the empty space into a sadeh, or the sadeh into migrash. It's just telling you the layouts of the amount of space that you need to leave. So, hocha, mishum noyer lo avdina. Nevertheless, even though you're allowed to change that empty space around the city into a sadeh, because of the beauty or aesthetics of the city, we don't allow you to plant trees within 25 amot or within 50 amot of the city. Ulrabana nami, the amre eno sim sadeh migrash lo migrash sadeh. And even according to the Rabbanan, this Mishnah is relevant, even though they say that you're not allowed to change that area, empty space around the city, the migrash, into a sadeh. Hani milei zraim. That's only talking about when you're talking about grains or plants, vegetation. Aval ilanot avdina. When it comes to trees, that you're allowed to plant over there. V'hocha. But despite the fact that you're allowed to plant trees in that area, mishum noya ir, lo. Because of the beauty of the city, you need to leave at least a certain amount of space that is completely empty. So based on the Rabbanan Shita, it would turn out that you would have to leave the first 25 amot, or possibly 50 amot, depending on what type of tree, empty around the city and not plant any trees. In the subsequent space, up to 1,000 amot, which is supposed to be migrash, open space, there you're not allowed to plant vegetation, but you are allowed to plant trees in that area. The difference being, Rashi notes it, and the Rabbeinu Gershom actually says it much more explicitly, is that when it comes to Mizraim versus Ilanot, there are two differences. The first of which is that when it comes to Zraim, once you've planted vegetation there, you can no longer walk in that area. It blocks your ability to traverse the area, whereas a tree, when it's planted, you still have the ability to tayel and to walk through the area because it does not inhibit your ability to take a walk in the area. The second difference is, with regards, he brings to Shabbat, that if you want to walk there on Shabbat, if there's vegetation and plants on the ground, if you walk on it, you might come to trample it or ruin it or pull it out, and then you'll be in violations of Isurei Shabbat, whereas by Ilanot, by trees, you can walk in between the trees and not have that problem. Given that, one is allowed in the Migrash, in that empty space around the city, to plant trees, according to the Chachamim, but there still is a buffer zone right up against the city where you may not plant trees, and that's that first 25 amot to 50 amot, and that's what's being discussed in our Mishnah. Ominat Demra, the shiny ben Zraim Lilanot. How do you know there's actually such a distinction between Zraim and Ilanot, whereby Zraim, you have to put a minimum of 1,000 amot away from the city, whereas Ilanot, you only need to give a buffer of 25 or 50 amot. Tanya, because we have a braita with regards to the Dinei Shabbat, Karpaf, Yotermi Beitza Ataim. A Karpaf is a large stretch of field or land that is greater than Beitza Ataim. Beitza Ataim is the size of the Mishkan, which is 50 by 100 amot. That is the area is considered to be Beitza Ataim. The Chachamim instituted that anything up to Beitza Ataim, if it's encircled with a wall, it's considered to be a Reshut Yachid, and you can carry it in that area. Once you exceeded the area of a Beit Sataim, then if the area is walled in, then the Chachamim said that it is not a Rishut Ayachid anymore. Even though Minat Torah is classified as a Rishut Ayachid, Mid Rabbanan, they classified it as a Karmelit, with the exception of the case of where the area is encircled or walled in the Dira, for living space. And therefore, a Karpaf that is larger than Beit Sataim, if the wall is put in there simply to encircle these fields, you will no longer be able to carry in there midrabanan. Then if you encircle it le dira in order to make it inhabitable space, then no matter how big it is, doesn't matter how big the space is, if the wall is there and it's made le dira to be lived in, then that space is considered to be reshut yachid and you can carry in it. So now, based on that, Mer brings a braita, karpaf yotermi beit satayim, shukaf le dira, that was encircled, the fence was put up, le dira, nizra rubo. If after the fact that he put up the wall and he planned on living there and using this as living space, which should allow you to consider it a reshut yachid, he goes ahead and plants vegetation over the majority of the space, it gets the status of a garden and no longer an area that is suitable for living in, and therefore it'd be vasur. You would not be allowed to carry around in that area because it would be deemed to be a karmelit, which is a reshut yachid dirabanan, which doesn't allow you to carry because of its similarities to a Reshut Rabim, or your lack of understanding that this is a Reshut Yachid. Nitarubo, on the other hand, if he planted trees over the majority of the space of that Korpaf, Haru Kechatzer, it has a din of a Chatzer Umutar, because of that difference that we just saw. That when you plant vegetation, it takes away the inhabitable space there, because, like the Rabbeinu Gershom says, you can't walk there. And on Shabbat, especially, you can't walk there because you're going to trample on the items. That'd be problematic on Shabbat. For both of those reasons, the space now is deemed to be a gina, a garden, or a field of vegetation. And we know that if you encircle an area that is not the dira with a wall, it's considered a karmelit, and that's why it's a sur. On the other hand, if you use that area and you plant trees over the majority of that area, you're still able to walk through that area. You're still able to go between the trees, whether because of Isurei Shabbat or whether because of just the physical barriers of the trees. They don't cause you a problem, the Gabay Shabbat and the Gabay moving around. And one could still use the area as an area of Dira with the trees vis-a-vis when it's vegetation that you can't do it. And so you see here that distinction between areas that are covered in trees that are still considered to be inhabitable space or aesthetically pleasing for dira versus vegetation, which is not classified in that way. And the Gemara says the same distinction is what we're making over here. And that's the way we live today, that we live in many places where we have trees that encircle our houses or our neighborhoods. And so the trees are not considered to be in conflict with the fact that these are residential areas and even serve to enhance the fact that these are residential neighborhoods. On the other hand, if you have vegetation or fields, generally those areas are not where people are living or creating residential neighborhoods because that's not considered to be an enhancement or aesthetically pleasing part of a residential neighborhood to have large tracts of vegetation near one's house. Now the Gemara says, Vima ir kadma, if this city was there first, kotseitz ve'enun tein damim, he cuts it down and he doesn't have to pay for it. Mishnah gabi bor, what is the difference between this Mishnah and an upcoming Mishnah that we're going to see with regards to a tree in one person's property and a bor, a cistern in the other person's property? There, diktani kotseitz ve'notein damim, over there it says that he has to cut it down and compensated for it. What's the difference over here? And over here it says that he cuts it down and he doesn't have to pay for it. So in the situation of a boar and a tree, the Mishnah over there says that if the tree was there first, then the bala boar has no claim against the individual because the tree was there first. When he put his cistern in, that was his problem. The fact that maybe the roots would interfere with his cistern later on because the tree was there first. The individual had the tree, had those rights. On the other hand, if it's the other way around, by which the tree was put there illegally, meaning that the cistern was there first, and then the other person planted the tree illegally, the Mishnah says, despite the fact that he planted the tree illegally, you can cut it down, but you do have to compensate him for the fact that you cut down the tree. On the other hand, in our Mishnah, it says that if the tree was there first, you cut it down and you compensate. On the other hand, if the city was there first, you cut down the tree and you don't compensate. So the Gemara wants to understand, why is there a difference in din between that which is taking place here with regards to the city, where if it's done legally, you can still cut it down and compensate, or it's done illegally, you cut it down and don't compensate, versus bor, where if it's done legally, you have no rights to cut it down whatsoever, and when it's done illegally, you can cut it down, but you have to compensate. What is the difference? So Amar Rav Kahana, Kidra de Beishutve, lo chamima velo karira. When it comes to a pot that belongs to multiple partners, it never gets hot and it never gets cold. This is what is otherwise known as diffusion of responsibility. When you have too many cooks in the kitchen, then nothing ever gets done because everybody thinks it's the other person's responsibility. And so similarly over here, the assumption is that when it comes to a city, if we rely on the members of the city over here to first have to collect money in order to compensate the individual to cut the tree down, in that situation, it's never going to get done. When you start to go collect the money, the person's going to say, well, don't start with me, start with him. Get the money from him, and then I'll give you money. And again, there'll be this diffusion of responsibility in which the tree will never be cut down. In the end, nimtza ha'ilanu meid, that tree will stay there, v'ayir miguneh, and the city will remain a city that is not aesthetically pleasing. Okay, if the people of the city want that, why is that a big deal? Vein zu tif eret Eretz Yisrael. You see here from Rashi, similar to the Ramban, that he thinks that this is related to Eretz Yisrael in particular, and that it's not proper for the glory of Eretz Yisrael and for Yishuv Eretz Yisrael that they shouldn't have this beauty surrounding the cities. And therefore, the Mishnah says over here that we give them the right to go in and cut it down and not compensate because of the fact we want it to be cut down. So given that, the din here is different. Here you can cut it down without compensating versus the case by the private domain where that's a personal issue of damage. Over there we'd say you can take it down, but you're going to have to compensate for it because over there there's only one responsible party. There's only one individual who's being affected and he wants to cut the tree down. He'll raise the money if he wants the tree cut down. So the Gemara explains that in the case where it's done illegally by the boer, you still have to compensate because there we're dealing with one party. And over here, by the case of the city where the tree was put there illegally, it was planted after the city was already in existence. And over there, we allow you to cut it down without having to pay in order to avoid this problem of diffusion of responsibility. The Gemara says, Umay Kushya, what's the question about the difference in din? Maybe it has nothing to do with what you just described. Dilma Shani Hezekah de Rabbi Mezekah de Yochid. It's a very simple distinction here between something that affects the public versus something that affects an individual. That when it comes to damage to a particular individual, We give him rights, but only limited rights. And that's why if it was planted there illegally, the neighbor has a right to demand that he cut it down, but he will have to compensate him for it. On the other hand, when it comes to a situation of a hezek derabim, where this tree is affecting the public at large, over there we grant the public larger powers to take down a tree like that. And they can take it down without having to pay, because that is something that is causing a problem for the entire city. Ella, idmar derav kana, aseifa idmar. When you want to invoke this principle of Rav Kahana about the fusion of responsibility, it's on the latter half of the Mishnah, not the first half of the Mishnah, which is, imalan kadam, if the tree had the right to be there, kotseitz v'notein damim. You cut it down, and then you have to compensate. V'lei ma'aluhu, the person who owns the tree should be able to say to them, pay me first, v'hadar ikotz, and then I'll cut it down. Meaning that he should be able to demand the fact that they pay up the money, since he's entitled to the money. He should have to get a prepayment for the value of the tree and then cut the tree down. Yet, over here it says, ikots, you first cut it down and then you compensate. So that's the question, not vis-a-vis the boar, but vis-a-vis itself. Why over here do you have a right to cut it down and then only afterwards ask for the money? So Amar Rav Kahana, kidra de beshutve lo chamima v'lo karira. When it comes to a pot that is being taken care of by multiple parties or by partners, never really gets hot, and never really gets cold. Again, the idea of diffusion of responsibility, whatever expression you want to use, but the problem is that if you leave it up to the public at large to bring together or garner the money, they will never successfully do it. So what we do is we cut the tree down, so we get rid of the problem, and then we leave the responsibility on the individual whose tree it was to go to Beit Din and compel the city to pay him for that money. And that way it will happen. If we let it happen the other way around, which is that the city first has to compensate and then cut it down, it'll never happen. First of all, because of this diffusion responsibility, they'll never get the money together. And number two is, the person who owns the tree has no vested interest in taking the tree down either. So he'll leave it up. So therefore, the momentum or the default scenario will be to leave the tree there. In order to facilitate the taking down the tree and to bring the tiferet back to the city, we say cut it first and then compensate after the fact. And that's where they invoke this principle of Rav Kahana. Safek zekadam, v'safek zekadam. In a case where we don't know which came first, the city or the tree, kotseitz v'notein damim. You cut it down and you don't compensate. Maishnam bibor. Why is this different than the upcoming Mishnah by a boar where there is a safek? When you have a safek, whether the boar was first or the tree was first, then we don't let you cut it down. Damart lo yikotz. That there, you're not allowed to cut it down at all. Mar says, hotam devadei lav lemekatz kai. In the case of the boar, it's not certain that you have a right to cut it down. If the tree was there first, I don't have the right to cut the tree down. If the tree was there illegally, I mean it came after the boar, then you have a right to cut it down. Therefore, in a case of safek, you have a safek as to whether you're entitled to cut it down or not entitled to cut it down. We say, motzi mechavero alav araya, and therefore we'll leave the tree there until you can prove that there's a necessity to take the tree down. So therefore, sveiko namelo amrinim leikotz. When there's a safek, we won't tell him to cut it down. Hocha davadai lemekatz kai. In our situation here, the tree is going to be felled no matter what. Whether the tree was there first or the tree was not there first, I mean legally or illegally, you have a right to cut the tree down. The only question is whether there is compensation or not compensation given for the cutting down of the tree. Therefore, sfeiko nami, when there's a safeg, amrin en leikotz, we say cut it down. Irrespective of what the outcome of that decision is regarding who was there first, the tree is coming down. So fell the tree, and then, imishum dmei, if you're talking about the money, amrin en leikotz, itiraya vishogol. We say to the individual who owns the tree, you bring the proof. The burden of proof is on you to show that you were there first in order to get your money, because emotzi mechavero ala varaya. So the burden of proof is different in these situations. By the case of the boar, the burden of proof is on the owner of the cistern to show that he has a right to cut the tree down. And that's why in a case of safek, we won't cut the tree down. In the case of the city, where by definition the tree is going to be taken down, the only question is, does he get compensated? Therefore, in a case of safek, we're going to take the tree down. And then the burden of proof will be on the owner of the tree to show that he's entitled to compensation. And that's why the din is different in our Mishnah than it is in the upcoming Mishnah of Bor. Now the next Mishnah says, Marchikin et a goren kavua min ha'ir chamishim ama. One has to at least distance a goren, where you're bringing a threshing floor together and you're working the produce from the fields. It must be distanced from the city a minimum of 50 amot. And here it's talking about a case where it's a goren kavua. Gemara will speak about what's the difference between a goren kavua and goren she'ina kavua. Lo yaseh adam goren kavua b'toch shelo. Person may not set up a threshing area within his own field. Elim ken yesh lo chamishim amah l'chol ruach. Unless he has a radius in all directions of 50 amot, in order that he does not disturb his neighbor's fields or cause problems for his neighbor's fields. So the same way that there is negative impact from doing a goren outside the city, within 50 amot of the city, the same is true in private property. If you're doing it in your own property, it will affect the properties around you. The main issue has to do with the motz, which is the way that they do zorea, the ruach, or the winnowing that is done. In the case of the winnowing that's done, the wind picks up all of the lighter scrap or waste that comes off of the grains, and it carries it away. When the wind carries it away, it's going to deposit it somewhere else. So if you do it near the city, it's going to deposit it in the city, and either ruin the people's gardens or houses or whatever they have in the city. And the same is true out in the fields, that if it lands on the plants, vegetation that's out in the fields, it's going to cause it to dry up because it's going to cover it or damage it. So because of that, we demand that you be at least a minimum of 50 amot away when you do this. Then, umarchik mitiotav shechevero uminiro. Person has to distance the goren away from the trees and the plowed field of his friend, kadesh lo yazik, in order that it does not do damage. So here again, there's a requirement that the goren be distanced from an empty field that is just plowed, as well as the fact that it's distanced away from other plantings here leaning towards trees of his friend. So Gemara asks the obvious question, Maishna Reisha or Maishna Seifa? What's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? In the fact that the Reisha says that it gives you a shiur of 50 amot and tells you that you must be a minimum of 50 amot away. And the Seifa, it says, Kadesh lo yazik. You just have to give it enough distance that it doesn't do damage. And the assumption, Rashi and Rabbeinu Gershom both say this, that by the case of 50 amot, that's a much larger span than Kadesh lo yazik, an area that would not cause damage. So why is there a kula in the latter part of the Mishnah that you don't get in the beginning of the Mishnah? Or what's the difference in the cases? Amar Abaye, Seifa atan the Goren Sheinu Kavua. The difference between the Reish and the Seifa is that the Reish is talking about a Goren Kavua, and therefore there's going to be a larger amount of discard that's going to come off of that Goren. And therefore you need a wider area or perimeter around it. On the other hand, the latter part of the Mishnah is talking about a case where the Goren Sheinu Kavua, where it's not a permanent goren, and therefore it's smaller. Given that it's smaller, you just have to distance it at a perimeter that won't cause damage, and not the 50 amot. The Gemara wants to understand, echidami goren sheinu kavua. How do you decide whether it is a goren kavua or a goren sheinu kavua? And Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, kol she'ein zoreh berachat. It's a question of when you are winnowing, do you have to use a pitchfork? In a case of a small goren, or a goren sheinu kavua, just when it's spread out, and when it's left out there, it's such a small pile, that the wind itself will do the winnowing without you having to lift up that which is in the pile. Now then, a goren kavua, which is much larger, the wind won't be able to reach or access the chaff that's there to blow it away. Elim ken, you start lifting it up and throwing it into the air. And that's zore l'ruach, you're throwing it up. So given the fact that you have a larger pile that you need to work with and you're winnowing by throwing it up, it's going to spread the chaff or the waste that comes from there much further because you're throwing it up in the air. And there's larger quantity of it, as well as the fact that you're throwing it up in the air. Given that, you need a wider berth or perimeter of 50 amot. In the case of goren she'eino kavua, where the wind does it without you having to lift it up, first of all, there's less chaff to start with. And in addition, it's being done by the wind right on the surface and not being thrown up into the wind. And therefore, the area or perimeter around which it affects is all kadesh lo yazik, is a smaller area. As long as it doesn't affect the areas around you, that's sufficient space to do something like that. That's Abaye's explanation. On the other hand, Rav Ashi Amar, Matam Kamar. The Mishnah is giving you the reason for the 50 amot. There's no difference between the Reish and the Seifa. It's simply explaining to you, why is it that you have to distance yourself 50 amot? Today shalo yazik, in order that you don't do damage to your neighbor's fields. My time amarchitin goren kavua min ha'ir chamishim amah. Why do you have to distance yourself away from the city 50 amot? Today shalo yazik, in order that it doesn't cause damage. That is the reason behind the 50 amot. Meitave. So now we bring a braita. Marchikin goren kavua min ha'ir chamishim ama. You have to distance a permanent goren away from the city 50 amot. Or really, it's not really a permanent goren, but a goren that is of a large enough size that you'd be using a pitchfork. You have to give yourself a minimum of 50 amot. G'shem shemarchikin min ha'ir chamishim ama. Just like you distance yourself from the city 50 amot. Kach marchikin midluav umikishuav umitziotav uminoro shel chavero chamishim ama. Similarly, you must distance yourself away from the vegetation, the zucchinis and gourds of your friend, as well as the young saplings and plowed field of your friend, 50 amot, kidei shelo yazik, in order that it won't cause damage. Bishlama le Rav Ashi Necha. Given the bright Rav Ashi's explanation of the Mishnah is very palatable because it's exactly like the Braita. For Abaye, this the Braita's explanation goes against the way that he explains the Mishnah. The Gemara says Kasha and leaves that as a question on Abaye's position. So you see two things from the Braita. First of all, it's explaining to you what the 50 amot are, because it says you need 50 amot in both cases, as well as the fact that the reason for the 50 amot is Kadesh Elo Yazik. So number one, it's clear that it's reading it like Rav Ashi, which is that in both instances, there's a requirement of 50 amot. And number two is, it's telling you the reason for the 50 amot is Kadesh Elo Yazik. That's not a different measurement of space. Kadesh Elo Yazik is the 50 amot. It's not giving you a different perimeter that you need to distance yourself from. Tosafot asks, why doesn't Abaye just say the Braita is speaking a case of a Gorin Kavua? And when it's speaking about a Gorin Kavua, you need 50 amot no matter what is near you, whether it's your neighbors, the city, anything you need. And that would be an easy solution or way for Abaye to explain the Braita. So Tosfot answers in the end, Hashta the Braita mefresh time kadesh liyazik, matnita nami ika lefrushe hochi. He says, because Abaye's reasoning in the Mishnah is because he thinks it's completely unnecessary. You don't need to tell me the Mishnah. The reason you need to give 50 amot is kadesh liyazik. That's obvious. And therefore, he reads our Mishnah as being two different shiurim, the shiurim of 50 amot and the shiur of Kadesh Elo Yazik. But once you have the Braita indicating that that's not the way to read the Mishnah, and that the way that to read the Mishnah is that Kelo Yazik is explaining the 50 amot, he's compelled then to say that the Mishnah is not using two different lishonot as two different shiurim, but simply explaining the Chamishim Ama. And given that, Abaye even would agree with Ravashi that the proper way to read the Mishnah is the way that Braita is indicating, and not the way that Abaye assumed, given the difference of language within the Mishnah. Now the Gemara says, Bishlama mikshuav midulav. I understand from his vegetation, the azal afko, because the dust or the chaff that comes off the goren, ba'ate bilibe, it goes into the heart of these items, umitzavile, and dries it out. You can see here in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, bilibe is beperach. It goes into the flower, and then mitzavile is menapcho umiabsho. He says it causes it to swell and grow and then dry out. Or you could just say simply, miabsho, mitzavile means to dry it out. But it seems somehow it either covers over the flower or it injures the flower in some way, the flowering of this vegetation, in a way or a manner that causes it that it will not grow the vegetables, or it injures the, or it reduces the production of the field because of the chaff. So I understand why you'd have to put the gorin away from these types of vegetations. Elaminiro amai. If it's a field that is simply plowed, why do you have to take your garden away from there? What's wrong with the chaff falling into that area? In addition, it's not only that it's not negative, it's actually positive. The chaff is organic material, which will decompose and act as fertilizer for the ground. So why is it they have to distance yourself away from the field that is plowed? And as Rashi notes over here, a plowed field that is fallow is because they plowed the field at the end of the last harvest. They plowed it at the harvest in order to uproot any weeds or vegetation that's left in the ground so that it's actually ready to be planted when it comes to the new planting season. So that's why they plowed it, and now the field is laying there plowed. You're not allowed to do your goren near there because of the chaff that comes into it. So Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda, Vitamar Rabbi Abba Bar Zutra, Mipnei, Shoseh Uta Galau. Because it's Marbelo Zevel, it puts in way too much fertilizer. You're right that it is beneficial and it is fertilizer, but it's too much. V'sarefet Azreim Shnizrubo. And it ends up destroying whatever is planted there because it's so powerful. I mean, there's too much fertilizer, and that's what causes the problem. And as Tosfot says, afagav de galau mashbiach hakarka shikula galau mazik. That even though fertilizer is good for the property, when you have too much fertilizer, it's detrimental to the property. And that's the reason you have to take this gorin, or place this gorin far away from a field that is empty and plowed, because it will do damage to anything that's planted in the field. And that's why you have to also ensure that you're not doing damage in that manner. Okay, we're going to stop here on the Mishnah on the top of Chaf Hei Amud Aleph.